From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida has a new state budget, but it appears public school districts still aren't sure how much money they'll have as the first day of classes draws nigh.
And they said, oh yeah, we're holding on to them to do some assessments and evaluations before releasing them.
Also this week, we'll take a behind-the-scenes look at how some statewide political races are shaping up way in advance of next year's election and what factors are still important.
A, are you running? B, did you speak to the governor? C, what did he say?
We'll also head out to Alligator Alcatraz, and we'll discover a new way your local public radio station can help keep you safe in the event of an emergency. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. A freeze on federal funds used to support after-school and summer programs throughout Florida could soon be lifted. That news comes after a push from a group of Republican U.S. senators and a lawsuit by Democratic teachers' unions. But as Margie Menzel reports, with classes set to start within a matter of weeks, many local school districts are still scrambling.
The funds that were paused normally go to help schools with a significant percentage of low-income students, for professional development for teachers, to teach English as a second language, and for after-school and summer programs. Officials say the Trump administration has now agreed to release some of those funds, but it's unclear which dollars will go where. For now, Tallahassee Democratic Representative Allison Tant says she's especially concerned about the impact on schools in the poorest neighborhoods.
By definition, Title I schools are the schools with the students who need the most support, the most extra support. These are not schools in upper middle class neighborhoods. These are schools that serve students and human beings who have greater need.
Tallahassee Democratic Representative Gallup Franklin, who represents one of the poorest counties in Florida, says schools were expecting to receive that money about July 1st.
And when they woke up, they weren't there. And when that happened, then they said, oh, yeah, we're holding on to them to do some assessments and evaluations before releasing them. And that's when the fire started and the conversation started to happen.
Franklin says that's made it hard for schools to plan. That's also been a concern for Lily Murphy, the executive director of Florida After School. She says now is the time for members of her organization to be getting ready. But not knowing whether the funds would be there has made that hard. She says the program spends nearly $70 million for about 56,000 students statewide.
They would normally be in the planning stages of purchasing materials, hiring their staff for the fall, getting programs ready to begin operating so that they can commence at the same time that the school does, so that parents have care and are able to work and not worry about where their kids are and that their kids are safe and well taken care of.
What the cuts could mean for parents and kids is a significant concern. Leon County School Board member Marcus Nicholas says the loss of after-school and summer programs could put parents who rely on the tutoring, snacks, and care for their children in a bind.
To be able to progress, these kinds of programs are crucial. When you talk about after-school snacks, when you're talking about, you know, tutoring services for those students who may not get the information the first time around in the classroom and need to have an individualized lesson. That's what these 21st century programs are designed and are built for.
Meanwhile, plans for a Democratic-backed lawsuit are underway. Andrew Spahr is president of the Florida Education Association, the state teachers union. He says his group is joining a lawsuit with other teachers' organizations to argue that all the funds are needed and must be released. I'm Margie Menzel.
A little more than halfway through 2025, but we are already anticipating the 2026 elections. And you know, that's going to really mark a changing of the guard in Florida politics, because Governor Ron DeSantis is going to be terming out. There are several races for some other jobs like state attorney general, CFO,
and they're going to feature candidates who have never really been elected to the job. So the situation now has led to a lot of buzz a year and a half out into who is going to run and where political factions may be breaking out. And several stories were out this week that might give some additional clarity on all that buzz. And to help bring that together, we have Tristan Wood to kind of break it down. Tristan, how goes it?
Going well, Tom, going well.
Okay, well, there was a story, I think, in the digital outlet The Floridian this week. It was about former House Speaker Paul Renner, and he was looking at a run possibly for governor. So tell us a little bit more about that, if you could.
Well, Liv Caputo of The Floridian reported that several people in the DeSantis administration told her that Renner met with the governor and told him he wanted to run in 2026. I spoke to her about her story.
I heard from some sources in the outskirts of the DeSantis administration that he had spoken to the governor about 2 weeks ago and had told him, hey, you know, I'm running for governor. And there's differing reports on what the governor's response to that was.
There's also buzz he has hired several political consultants to start to look into his chances.
But what about Renner? What did he have to say about all this?
In text messages to Caputo, he didn't confirm or deny it.
He didn't really mention anything about him specifically. It was a bit of a non-answer in terms of, hey, A, are you running? B, did you speak to the governor? C, what did he say? Instead, it was, we need to defeat the Democrats. Whoever runs, let's get that done.
Now, in politics, very often a non-answer like that speaks volumes. If it was completely untrue, he would have just denied it.
Yeah, you kind of have to look at the negative space or the notes that aren't played, right? But what are his chances when you look at all this? Does he have a shot?
So very little polling is available yet, but a St. Pete poll survey gave him 2% support in a four-way race between other hypothetical Republican candidates like Rep. Byron Donalds, Casey DeSantis, and Florida Agriculture Commissioner Wilton Simpson. Now, to Barry University professor Sean Foreman, Renner's chances of winning are very slim.
Not discounting anything from Paul Renner's capabilities or his record in the legislature, but he's just not very well known across the state. And really, it seems like the deal maker in Florida is getting Donald Trump's endorsement, and that's already gone to Byron Donalds.
Okay, Tristan, let's shift gears a little bit. There were also some waves being made in the CFO race this year. So what's the deal on that? Explain it to us.
So Governor DeSantis appointed State Senator Blaise Ingolia to state CFO this week, despite State Senator Joe Gruters having Trump's endorsement for the job in 2026. Ingolia is an ally of DeSantis, and Gruters championed several bills that attempted to weaken DeSantis's power in the state during the special sessions earlier this year and the session this year. So DeSantis was really aggressive against Gruters at this press conference.
So if George Washington rose from the dead and came back and tapped me on the shoulder and said, will you appoint Joe Gruters CFO? My response would be, no, I can't do that. Without betraying the voters that elected me to lead the state in a conservative direction.
So there's no love lost between a lot of these politicians, and Gruters has expressed that he intends to remain in the race for 2026, meaning an Ingolia-Gruters standoff seems inevitable at this point.
Oh, great. So what do you make about that standoff? What's the deal on it?
Well, a common theme among political watchers is that since the Florida Democratic Party is so behind in registration, turnout, and other metrics, the real determination on who wins Florida's statewide offices in 2026 will be in the Republican primaries. So Foreman says that's a key part of the reason why we're seeing this clear factional split right now in the Ingolia-Gruters race, is that that's where the decision of who controls power is going to be decided.
You don't see Republicans worried about any Democrats. They're just worried about their internal battles.
Who has the edge in that race remains to be seen. Gruters has Trump's endorsement, but now Ingolia has the office to use the bully pulpit it gives him to pound the table on issues in an attempt to win over Republican primary voters and increase his name ID. So it's really unclear who should be the front runner at this point.
Capitol reporter Tristan Wood bringing us up to date on all of the behind-the-scenes activity in the ever-fascinating world of Florida politics. Thanks, Tristan.
No problem, Tom.
Coming up on Capitol Report, we'll hear from someone who knows more than a little bit about the area now occupied by the detention facility called Alligator Alcatraz.
Now, if you go out to the site, you're going to see a lot of traffic, a lot of noise.
The state of Florida goes its own way when it comes to accreditation for public colleges and universities.
There's no question that this is a foundation rocker.
And when emergencies happen, your nearest public radio station is now offering a new way to connect with potentially life-saving information. As executive director of Friends of the Everglades, Eve Samples is following in the footsteps of one of the state's most revered conservationists, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, in more ways than one. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Hamm podcast, she delves into a lawsuit challenging an immigrant detention center in the Everglades dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. Here's an excerpt.
Tell me what you've seen when you've gone out there or what you're hearing from reports of other people.
So I haven't been on the site and, you know, allowed into the site since it opened. And I'm sure you saw state lawmakers were turned away as well. Let me share first a little bit about being in Big Cypress when before this happened.
Yes. Thank you. I love do that.
Actually, it's my favorite Everglades experience. I went on a swamp walk very close to this area in Big Cypress National Preserve behind Clyde Butcher's gallery there.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Guided swamp walk. And Clyde Butcher, the black and white photographer known for his Everglades images.
Yeah. Really big, very gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's in his 80s and he's been engaged in this fight because he feels so strongly. But anyhow, some years ago, I did a swamp walk behind his gallery, and I'm not very tall, so water came up to about my waist, and it was incredible to be immersed under the cypress dome. The water's clear. You're walking on limestone bottom. Mm-hmm. The serenity of that moment. Yes, there are alligators nearby. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are other snakes and critters nearby, but I felt nothing but peace in that moment. And there's some real irony in, like, these men with big titles talking about how scary the alligators are and the snakes and they'll keep everybody away, when many people actually enjoy this ecosystem and maybe they should give it a shot. So that's what it was like. Now, if you go out to the site, you're going to see a lot of traffic, a lot of noise, puffs of pollution coming out of big trucks, protesters at the entrance a lot of days. And at night, you will see the big lights in the distance. And, you know, a lot of these vehicles going in have their DOT numbers covered up.
I saw that.
Yeah. And we had images early on of Department of Homeland Security vehicles moving in, photographs of that. Lately, they've been big white unmarked buses going in. So that's interesting to observe. The increasing activity. And this is a two-lane road, Tamiami Trail, the road leading there. It's about an hour east of Naples and almost 2 hours west of Miami. It's not designed for this kind of bustling activity. It's really the middle of nowhere.
That was Eve Samples with Friends of the Everglades on the Deeper Dive with Derek Hamm podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. The Florida Board of Governors has approved a new higher education accreditor, the Commission for Public Higher Education. WUSF's Douglas Soule tells us what it could mean for state universities.
State universities and colleges need to be accredited. Accreditors review and create higher education standards. They give institutions access to government funding, students access to financial aid, and they give graduates' degrees credibility. They can even affect what students are taught. Yet, Florida State University student body president Carson Dale says most students don't know much about accreditation.
Kind of behind the scenes, but obviously it's a very important thing when it comes to financial aid, course transfers, graduate school, all of that good stuff.
But Peter Lake, a Stetson University law professor and higher education expert, predicts the change will bring this process to the forefront.
I think this could be the single biggest shift in regional and national accreditation in living memory of almost anybody who's connected to higher education.
Governor Ron DeSantis has been fighting the accreditation process for years. He's taken issue with Florida's accreditor, called the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges. Then, the governor announced a new accreditor late last month, saying the current one is biased toward progressive ideologies.
When we said no DEI, the accreditor was telling our universities, oh, no, no, you're not going to get accredited unless you do DEI. Who the heck are they to say what our universities have to do?
The Florida Board of Governors oversees state universities.
It will provide institutions with an alternative that focuses on student achievement rather than the ideological fads that have so permeated those accrediting bodies over the years.
Five other southern states want to be involved and will help lead it. Under current law, the U.S. Department of Education has to approve the accreditor. Stetson Law professor Lake thinks the Trump administration is willing.
It's up to observers to decide whether that's positive or negative, but there's no question that this is a foundation rocker.
He thinks the new organization will stress topics like American civics and put more pressure on professors over what they teach and their outcomes.
I think teachers may actually feel much more direct impact from accreditor oversight in day-to-day classroom management than they've experienced in the past.
Still, without knowing the possible new standards, he says the effects are unknown, including on students.
You don't know, but the new accreditors, for example, might impose new curriculum requirements that people have to meet that have not existed before. And that could put stress on people who are transiting through the system at the time and people who are planning on going.
Lake thinks higher education overhauls could lead to what he calls a renaissance. But he also worries accreditation regions may become defined by their politics.
Is this the place that resonates with me, my values? Is this what I want to purchase or buy into? And I think as the accreditation system potentially creates more variety, it potentially creates the possibility of more affinity shopping.
The politics involved is a big concern for Anita Levy of the American Association of University Professors.
Right-wing politicians and legislators have learned that a robust, well-regarded accreditation system presents some kind of barriers to, frankly, to their attempts to inject partisan control into institutions of higher education.
The Florida Education Association and the United Faculty of Florida are also speaking out. They say a politically driven accreditor will damage the credibility and reputations of state schools. But FSU student body president Carson Dale likes the idea of the new accreditor. Other student presidents picked him to serve on the Florida Board of Governors.
First and foremost, you know, innovation and competition is a great thing. And I think that's what this allows for a model, you know, to exist in.
A state university system spokesperson says the new accreditor will, quote, maximize efficiency without sacrificing quality. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
A new Florida law aims to protect student-athletes before they even step onto the field. Jasmine Sutherland reports first-time athletes are now required to get a heart screening called an electrocardiogram.
The Second Chance Act is named in memory of Point St. Joe High School football player Chance Gaynor. He died after experiencing cardiac arrest during a game.
I think it's very important to find underlying conditions that maybe, you know, the standard physical would not detect.
That's Heather Peacock, a longtime friend of the Gaynor family.
My son plays football with Chance, and we were all there the night of his death, and that really has made a huge impact on our family, and I'm thankful for the strength that his mother has to continue pushing for this, and I'm glad my children, all three of them that are in school, were able to get their EKG today.
During an event in Point St. Joe, athletes received heart screenings and professionals taught CPR. The bill's sponsors, Tallahassee Republican Senator Corey Simon and Point St. Joe Republican Representative Jason Schoaf, were also on hand. For Simon, who played football, the bill hits close to home.
I had a good friend that passed away on the field, and so to know that you're going to make an impact for the least of these, our young people, and they'll have an opportunity to grow up and also participate in what they enjoy doing.
Schoaf sponsored the House version. He says some critics were worried the cost of screenings could keep low-income students from participating in sports, but he's glad the bill got over the finish line.
I think it's easy sometimes to get stuck in your old ways and out of fear of change. And we've seen some deep-rooted medical industries fight this. They say it's too expensive, which we've proven it's not. They say that it's going to eliminate poor kids from playing sports. Well, I think that's absurd. It's not at all. It's actually going to stop them from dying.
Shoaf hopes to work with the state and other organizations to help find funding that could cover the cost of more extensive screenings for kids who get an irregular EKG result. I'm Jasmine Sutherland.
If you've ever wondered what would happen if you decided to unplug for an extended period, kids at the KLA Academy in Miami have an answer for you. A group of fifth graders at the private school tried something most kids would never agree to, namely giving up their phones, tablets, and video games for 3 weeks. As WLRN's Carla Mendez reports, the experiment became more than just a detox.
On their last day of school, students at KLA Academy headed into summer break with a new perspective on technology and how to use it.
The struggle is real, guys.
Some days I actually really feel like I'm about to quit.
It's kind of hard with all these devices around us. Our world is just turning into devices.
I'm a kid and I'm supposed to be like having like interactions with my family, and my dad told me that he felt more connected to me. Now I just want to use my device for like texting and taking selfies with my friends.
Those are fifth graders Elena, Maggie, Ava, Olivia, and Penelope. Just a few of the 19 students who took part in what they called the Digital Detox Diaries. These were some of their comments recorded during the detox. For 21 days, they gave up their devices, no phones, no video games, just TV and a no-screens rule 1 hour before bed. It was part of a classroom experiment led by their teacher, Amy Krehor, after students started questioning what all their screen time might be doing to them.
So as teachers, we're more facilitators of learning, so we pay really close attention to what the students are interested in, what they're doing.
Krehor noticed how often the students were on their screens. So they studied how technology works, how it has evolved over time, and how it affects our health. Students were split into two research teams. Engineers focused on the mechanics of technology, while the social scientists studied the human side. Their research led them to a boarding school in Australia that banned phones, a documentary called Swipe, and the work of psychologist Jonathan Haidt. Soon, the class began asking, what would happen if we tried this?
We thought we would have a control group and an experimental group, and we ended up having all of them try it.
The experiment was voluntary, but every student took part. Krehor says they encouraged one another to try it. Ava O'Brien and Alana Contese Quintero emerged as class leaders. Together, the class agreed on the rules. Parents were instrumental in the process, too, offering their support and keeping record of weekly reflections as their kids adjusted to life offline. Then came the hard part.
Oh my God, I can't survive.
Like Ava, Elena says she was tested in ways she didn't expect.
Patience? I don't have patience for anybody.
Others like Maggie notice a change in her behavior after just a few days without devices.
Before I would get mad and like destroy everything around me, but this time I know how to control myself and I know how to like stop. So I feel like the detox is really helping me.
By day 15, Maggie had picked up a new hobby.
I started a book, like a book from my house. I would have never done that if my iPad was there. Like I started a book.
Students like Alana reported better sleep, clearer focus, and more time spent socializing or trying new things.
Also recently had a playdate with Vale. We just like went outside and we talked for like 4 hours. We were so refreshing.
At school, Krehor and her colleagues noticed shifts in the classroom dynamic.
One student who would come in the morning and barely say hello to us started to hug us every morning.
Ava's dad, Gus O'Brien, says the project extended beyond just the students.
It gave our kids good permission to call us out if we were stopping halfway through a conversation and texting, and the kids are like, yeah, we're here. It made everyone a bit more patient, a bit calmer.
For many of the kids, the biggest insight came not from quitting screens, but understanding what makes them so addictive.
Before I started learning about this stuff, I would really not care if I was scrolling the whole day. And then I learned about oxytocin, then I learned about dopamine, and I learned what phones can do to you. And so then I was like, why am I doing this?
Alana also says the detox strengthened her bond with her brother.
We would like watch movies together, and like I felt like we were way more connected, and I like love my brother when I see him like that.
The goal was never to abandon technology. It was to have a better understanding of the science behind how it shapes our brains, our relationships, or even how it can be isolating. And for Alana and Ava, they plan to take these new habits with them into middle school.
Because I do not want to go back to my screen and be addicted on it again.
It's amazing how 3 weeks can change your whole life.
I'm Carla Mendez in Miami.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a free app has been launched to help Floridians prepare for severe weather and other emergencies. WGCU's Sandra Victorova reports.
News teams work round the clock during hurricanes to broadcast everything from evacuation orders to storm safety tips while still delivering other news. Delivering safety information specific to each community can be a challenge. It can also be frustrating for police and fire departments, hospitals, and local governments. That's why Randy Wright and his team at the University of Florida have spent several years working with the Florida Division of Emergency Management to launch Beacon. That's the Broadcast Emergency Alerts and Communications Operations Network. It's a broadcast system that allows local emergency managers and government leaders to transmit specific alerts to residents in the communities they serve.
And in working with emergency management and public safety, sometimes they're concerned that their message gets lost in everything that's going on with a disaster. There's no news, there's no editorial information, there's no commercials, there's nothing other than alerts. If there's a burn ban that's going on, if there's a boil water order that's happening, or if there's a closure on I-75, all of that type of information that's being fed into the system by the agencies responsible for them.
Listeners can get alert notifications and listen to them via this app.
Burn ban notice from the city of LaBelle.
And even when communities lose cell phone and internet coverage, Beacon continues to be broadcast on local radio channels.
We continually hear about the only thing I could get was radio because it's the most resilient medium out there. While the app works wonderfully and is great, for those times when connectivity is out, power is out, Beacon will be there on the radio. For a number of public broadcasters in the state of Florida, it's just natural within our mission to be able to provide that conduit for emergency management agencies and other government agencies to be able to talk to the public.
The alert information is written by public safety and government agencies. Then once it's fed into Beacon, the AI technology turns it into digital voices that can speak 9 languages.
De la División de Manejo de Emergencias de Florida.
Within a minute from the time that they enter the alert into the system, it's being broadcast, and then it's being repeated so that that agency can constantly update the public on the latest about whatever the public needs to be alerted to.
Beacon also includes weather maps. And Wright says if you evacuate from your community, that's not a problem. You can ask the Beacon app to deliver alerts from the area you're traveling to, or just turn the dial to the public radio station serving that community. Each one has a Beacon channel.
That was WGCU's Sandra Victorova reporting. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm, Douglas Soule, Jasmine Sutherland, Carla Mendez, and Sandra Victorova. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.